Okay, so today we're going to continue talking about human perception, action, and cognition. So yesterday I introduced the ecological theory of perception from James Gibson. We'll get back to it in a later class when we look at theories and models in general. So what I wanted to go through today was some aspects of human perception. We'll talk a little bit about what are action and a little bit about cognition. And the point here is to just make us aware, and by us I mean including myself, of all the things we don't know about humans. And so when you design for human users, it's important to try to work with people who are specialists in those areas. And part of the aspect of HCI being a multidisciplinary field is that you get to work with psychologists, sociologists maybe, and if you look at group interaction, and specialists of human factors, as it's called in some places, and it's very interesting. I've learned a lot by collaborating with a psychologist called Iguia. His name will come up. And what is interesting is the methods they use are very rigorous. And especially in France, I don't know for people from other places, but in France, if you use the word psychology, it has a very sort of soft connotation, like, you know, you lie down on the couch and someone speaks to you. So, no, this is not, you know, there is, in psychology, there is clinical psychology where you look at people who have problems, and so you look at the medical aspect of trying to cure people, and a lot of psychological problems are in the mind, and then there's a branch of this that's psychiatry and all that. But this is all clinical psychology. But then there's also what's called experimental psychology, where the goal is to understand how humans and animals work. And this is a very rigorous science. They do a lot of testing, laboratory experiments that are extremely well-controlled, as an example. And it's an inspiration for what we do in HCI. In our work as researchers, we do a lot of controlled experiments, try to understand why interface A is better or worse than interface B, and what it means. And if you work in industry, you are supposed to do these things as one of the evaluation techniques. So those of you in the first year at CIB, you will take a whole class on evaluation methods, taught by Caroline. And a lot of it will be about controlled experiments. And for those of you in the other masters, well, you'll get to hear about it in other classes. So let's go back to the topic today. As we all know, the visual sense is the most developed for humans. And some people who say that, you know, up to half of your brain power is used to process visual information. I frankly don't know where they get this from. I don't know how you measure brain power, so I don't know how you assess half of brain power. I think a lot of these things are done by looking at what's happening in the brain through different imaging technologies. And certainly, visual information triggers processes all over the brain, although there are some areas that are very well known and well identified for some types of processing. And visual processing is something that, you know, has been, you have entire books about it, and there are still things we don't know. So some of the things we know: your visual field is very large, about 180 degrees. So that means that I can perceive things, you know, without looking right and left on the side. Now, we're going to do one of the little experiments. This one's going to be interesting because you're going to be slapping each other. I want you to get your arms like this. So the goal is, you know, if you look straight in front of you, how far can you go and you can still say that you're seeing your arms? So you have to go, so like, that's hard, I know, but you can take turns or something. Are you sure? I mean, it's hard, and I see some people cheating here.
But,
So now the thing I want you to do is, once you think you've reached the limit of your field, I mean, I'm trying to do it. It's hard. It is hard because you do move your eyes. So I'm about here. Now I'm going to move my hand. And I'm going to continue, and I should be able to perceive further afar field with my hands moving. Okay? No? You want to try it? So, you start here, you move, and there you say, oh, my arms are gone. And then you move them, and oh, they're back. Okay? Well, try this at home.
So, what this means is,
more sensitive to motion in the peripheral field of vision. As you know, the back of the eye has all these cells to capture light, but they're not evenly distributed. So it was called the fovea, the place of maximum acuity, which is in the middle of the eye, so straight in front of you. The visual acuity is very high, 0.04 millimeters. That's really tiny. And that's at 50 centimeters, because of course it should be specified as a solid angle. But if you are at 50 centimeters, and I take this distance because that's more or less the distance between you and the screen if you're working at the computer, 0.04 millimeters. Very acute. But as you go towards the periphery, there are fewer cells, so acuity gets lower. Also, perception of color is less good on the sides than in the middle. In fact, on the sides, we only perceive black and white. Which is amazing, because it's not at all the experience we have. We feel like we perceive color all on the side. But we can make experiment that your brain memorizes color, so still assigns it to objects that are in the peripheral vision. So as you go towards peripheral vision, you are less sensitive to colors, but you are more sensitive to motion, which is my hand wiggling experiment. And any idea why? Think caveman.
Safety,
yes. So, you know, if you are out there in the wild and you're a caveman looking for food, presumably, and if a prey attacks you, it's probably going to be from behind. That's what preys do, right? So it's more important to see a prey than to see the color of the prey. So the reason that, in an evolutionary perspective, we are very sensitive to motion and size is because it's a survival skill. But we're also sensitive to motion, and a general thing about senses is that we tend to be more sensitive to changes than to things that don't change. So another experiment that you can try, but you have to be out in the wild, is if you try to find a bird in a tree, it is very difficult. It is very difficult. However, if you're, you know, staring at a tree and the bird flies out, you immediately see it. So what this tells us is that the sense of vision is really not at all the kind of thing you can do easily with a computer. You can replicate with a computer. And the reason why vision systems are so hard to build with computers is that the processing, you know, the computer gets an array of pixels with colors. Now with Kinect, you sort of get some 3D information. But this is very low level, and you process it sort of line by line and things like this. Our brain has neurons that fire when they detect vertical lines, and they have other ones for horizontal lines, and they have other ones for different shapes. And there is a whole field of study that you'll hear more about if you take the information visualization class, which is called pre-attentive perception.
So pre-attentive perception is this idea that there are information, there is information you can perceive, even if it flashes at you very quickly. So I didn't include in there because I didn't want to spend too much time, and I'm already spending too much time. But you can do experiments where you flash images. You can flash a bunch of images of, say, animals, and in the middle of it you put an image of someone you know. You will spot it immediately. It's called pre-attentive because it doesn't require attention. You don't have a stimulus that is long enough to allow you to focus your attention, which means that your brain gets essentially one firing of neurons to do the processing. You can't do any high-level processing. This is very important for information visualization, because it tries to find ways of representing information that are captured immediately. There's been a number of studies before coming to this notion of pre-attentive perception that were trying to understand these things, and it was done under the name of Gestalt perception. Gestalt is a German word that means the whole. So perceiving things as a whole. And in Gestalt perception, there's a number of rules that says, you know, if I show you a grid of, I have this slide in the future class, so a grid of dots, if they're completely on a square grid, you just see a blob of dots. Now, if I make the vertical spacing a little bit smaller than the vertical spacing, but smaller than the horizontal one, suddenly you see lines. So our vision system is really works by perceiving high level features more than low level ones. So things like alignments, like groupings, etc. So of course, when you design interfaces, this is an important thing to know about and to use. And you can turn to two types of specialists for this. One is the specialist in human perception and human vision, so psychologists. But the other, who is the other group who knows about this thing?
Medicine?
Doctors?
Neurologists?
Yeah. Don't think science.
Designers,
visual designers, artists, and designers. And they know it in a very different way, because I don't think they learn very much about the human perceptual system in their classes, although I'm sure they do. But along, you know, centuries since Lascaux, so it's really millennia, of painting and drawing and creating visual representations, a lot of knowledge has been acquired about what works and what doesn't, and what to do to get some effect. And if you worked with someone who has been trained in typography, for example, it's amazing because, you know, whatever you try to do in Word, it's going to look like shit. And then this guy comes in and it changes two fonts and two spacings and suddenly looks nice. Right? So that's the other people to turn to when you try to improve the visual aspect of your interface. And here I'm not talking what is called eye candy, things that looks good for the sake of looking good. It's really how to make visual representations more efficient. Yes?
Actually, there is an author quite famous, he is called Edward Tufte.
Yes, I was going to mention. Yeah. So Ed Tufte has written several magnificent books, and you... Edward, that is called Ed, and he has really worked on how to do more with less. He's done a lot of work on, well, you know, if you open the newspaper or if you go on the news website, they always put these diagrams with these bar charts or these pie charts, and they're always wrong, not in that they don't necessarily convey the right information. They're misleading, and they're also oftentimes overloaded with things, you know, like the 3D bar graphs, for example, are just insanely stupid. And so he's done a lot of work to say, well, how much can you remove to still make things readable and, in fact, easier to read? And so, for example, in a bar graph where you have the axis, One way is you can draw horizontal lines to help compare visually things. But the thing is, you can draw the lines in white. So your vertical bar charts are sort of cut into little blocks. And it uses less ink, in a sense. And you still perceive it much as well, even better. So there is a whole field, and now this notion of using infographics in news reporting is a very hot topic, and there's a lot of work being done to have together people who work about the data and who work on the representation and on the graphs. So that's more the field of information visualization. But even if you do a regular interface, you know, oftentimes you want to try to remove the visual clutter, try to make things easier on the eye, try to put less things on the screen. And so there are choices at the level of what does need to be displayed or not, but then how does it need to be displayed? For example, on the Macintosh, when you have an error message, it tends to show the error message in black. And then if there is extra information or help, it tends to be written in gray on a white background. So just using black versus gray gives you, plus changing the font size, gives you a sense of importance. It also means that if you don't focus on the details, you're not bothered by the small print message. So, I mean, there are a million rules like this that can help, and they take advantage of our knowledge, either, I would say, explicit knowledge acquired by psychologists, or the more implicit knowledge that graphic designers and visual artists have developed over centuries to know what works and what doesn't for our vision system. So there's two things. I did a couple of slides compared to what you had online, because I was talking about this a little bit yesterday. Yeah. And so I found the reference is Held and Hein, 1963. Probably an experiment you would be allowed to do today. And so the experiment is you take two cats. In fact, you take two kittens. In fact, you take them when they were born, and you keep them in the dark, which is why I'm not sure you do this thing today, although, you know, maybe. And then you put them into this thing, which is not a torture device. The way it works is the two kittens are in two sides of this thing here. They're in fairly similar... I don't know what you call them, bags?
Baskets.
Baskets, thank you. And except that one of them has his legs sticking out, and he can touch the ground, and he can move. The other one is passive. So this is active kitten, this is passive kitten. So when this one starts walking, the thing, you know, it can walk in turn, it can only walk in a circle, but he can also turn into himself, he can decide to go backward, for example. So his motion is exactly replicated for the passive kitten. And so you take them out of their dark room, you put them into this, you turn the light on, and you let them do what they want to do. And so this cat is going to start moving around and moving all sorts of things, and this one is going to watch. And then after that, you do a number of tests to see how their vision system develops. Well, the funny thing is that even though both cats have been exposed to the exact same visual stimuli, they've seen exactly the same thing because they've been subjected to the same motion, this one is going to develop a normal vision system and not this one. Essentially, is staying blind. Not blind, it does respond to visual stimuli, but is not able to orient himself, for example. And so the lesson for this... And this is an extremely well... This is an example of the type of controlled experiment that we do in the lab. Well, we don't do it with cats, we do it with humans. And we try to not turn them blind. and not hurt them in general.
But these are experiments where when you run the experiments, you are supposed to have your experimental protocol go through an ethics committee that makes sure that what you're doing is not harming people. And so this particular experiment, I think, was done with 20 pairs of cats. So you replicate to make sure the thing you observe is not just by chance or lack of chance. And then you run statistics on the results to make sure that the effect you observe is indeed not chance, but the real effect, with certain confidence. So here the results are pretty striking, and I'll put online a reference to a paper that summarizes the experiment. And the conclusion is that self-produced movement, so the ability to move yourself, and to at the same time have concurrent visual feedback, so to see the effect of your emotion on what you perceive, are essential to the development of what they call visually guided behavior. So the development of the part of the visual system that helps you guide your motor system. Now, the story is not so bad for this cat, because if you get him out of the basket and then run around in the light, it becomes absolutely normal. So in the end, nobody was hurt. And this is the other thing I was talking about yesterday, which is the Ames Room. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it yourself on the web. So this is what you see. So imagine you go to this place. I know there's one in the Exploratorium in San Francisco, but that's a little bit far. But if you ever get there, go to the Exploratorium. It's like, actually, since you're in Paris, there are two good places to go. I don't think they have an Ames Room, but there's a Palais de la Découverte. And there's another place, a science museum in Lafayette. And I mean, last time I've been there, I thought it was.
How do you spell it?
I'm sorry?
How do you spell it?
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. So, Palais de la Découverte, which I like because it's a little bit old fashioned. And now, the more modern one is what's it called? Cité des Sciences. Can you read? No, you can't. Cité des Sciences. It's in La Villette. Two L's at La Villette? Not sure. Another excellent place to go is the Musée du CNAM. So this is Arts et Métiers, and they have a whole bunch of machines there. The interesting thing that I didn't know until recently is that when you go around the museum, there are tracks in the ground. And it turns out that a long time ago when they were teaching, they would have the machines brought into class to demonstrate how they worked. And so some of them were just big, heavy, printing machines or steam machines, steam engines, or all these things. So they had them rolled around the whole museum, which was not the museum at the time, to show them to students in class. Anyway, this is a nice place to go if you're interested in technology and science and hands-on, the first two for hands-on experiments. So the Ames Room is, so imagine you go there with your family or friends, and you look at the room from the outside here, and then your friends go in, and you have this stunning perception that some have become really huge, and some are small, even though they look like they are at the same distance. And the way this works is that the shape of the room is actually something like this. Because there's no mystery. For something to look small, it has to be far away. I mean, as far as humans are concerned. You cannot shrink them yet. So I think another way to look at this, so what happens is this person is much further away. How is it that you feel, your sensation is that it is really at the same distance as this one? Well, it's because the inside of the room is distorted. And the reason you can only look through this peephole, and actually I asked the question,
Can you look, what happens if you look with two eyes? Because I think someone asked that yesterday. Well, it doesn't break the illusion. Really. So you have to look through here because the perspective has been created for this particular viewing point. If you look from here, you would see that something is wrong in the shape of the room. But the way the room is shaped here, when you look at it from here, this line here and this lines correspond to this and that. But because this gets higher, you perceive as it's an horizontal line. And we're trained to perceive that if something looks horizontal, it is horizontal, even though it could be the projection of many different lines. And this is what it's doing there. So the person is in fact standing there, but your brain is telling you that this point is at the same distance as this one, and therefore this object looks smaller. So it's a very clever clever trick. It's amazing because even when you know how it is, how it works, it doesn't break the illusion. Now, in a more general way, and the reason I put a slide on this today is because one way to better understand perception is to study perceptual illusions. And there are lots of visual illusions. So this is an illusion. What you perceive is not reality. I will put a couple of pointers, we don't have time, to a couple of websites that have really amazing visual illusions. And in a moment I'll show an auditory illusion. And you can actually take advantage of illusions when you design interactive software. I'll show an example about hearing. So, I mean, about visual perception, it's a subject that would take hours and hours to cover. So, the things I've shown you were just, show that things are not as simple as they seem, and there's a lot to. There are a lot of things to know about if you want to do a visual design. For hearing, there has been much less research on hearing than on vision. I mean, it's, I don't know, at least a factor of 10, maybe 100, if you look at the literature. So we don't understand, we understand even less about hearing. One thing that hearing shares actually with vision, even though I didn't mention it, is that it works over an amazingly large range of stimuli. So for hearing, the scale of decibels? So it's a logarithmic scale. Because perceptually, every time the pressure of the airwaves doubles, we perceive it as a linear, more or less linear increase in the loudness. So the decibel was created to be a perceptual measure of how loud the sound is. And even though it's a logarithmic scale, we can hear sounds between fractions of a decibel to, well, I think around 95 your eardrums start exploding. So, but it's an absolutely unbelievable range of sensitivity from very small, very small air pressure to extremely large ones. And no microphone, for example, can do that. The reason, there's a whole profession around being sound engineer is to try to replicate with microphones the capabilities of our hearing system. And I was saying it's the same thing for the visual system, where you can see in almost pitch dark, and you can see in bright sun. Most cameras you have to adjust, or they have a limited range. So our senses in general, and it will be true of touch as well, have incredible ranges, and they are based on perceiving variations rather than state. Now, there are things that we don't understand about hearing, and one is the cocktail party effect. Does anybody know what that is? So, have you ever been to a cocktail party? Or party? Okay, so typically, you have ambient noise, and you have a bunch of people who speak. Now, in a cocktail party, you tend to not have loud techno playing in the background. It's more quiet. So you essentially have people talking in small groups. And the cocktail party effect is that you can stand in the middle of the room and you can decide to focus your attention, your auditory attention, to one group versus another. Now, with the eyes, of course, I can decide to look there or to look there, but I'm controlling my eyes, and my eyes have, as we saw, different characteristics in the focal area, and in the periphery. It's not the same for the ears. They have much more global perception. And literally, we don't know how it is we're able to distinguish different sources by focusing our attention without being able to focus our ears. Other effects we don't, we understand a bit better, but still, it's the masking effects. So when there are two sounds, under what circumstances is one sound going to hide another? Now, intuitively, if you have a very loud sound and the sound is very faint, the very faint one is going to disappear. Well, the difference in loudness for the second sound to disappear will also depend on their pitch, on their respective frequencies. So if you have a very high-pitched sound and low-pitched sound, you will tend to distinguish them a lot more, even if one is way louder than the other. If they are in the same frequency range, they will hide each other more easily. Yes?
Could you explain again about the cocktail party? You mean that if we cannot look in a group,
yes,
the group we're focused on, our
yes,
ears cannot do it by themselves?
It's not in the ears, because you can stay steady, so your ears get the same stream, but it's then your brain that is able to somehow decide, I want to focus on this group or that group. There is probably some discrimination that is able in distinguishing different sources in terms of their location. Because that's another thing, is how do we hear the 3D location of the source? We have two ears. And again, like for eyes, the stereo effect disappears if the sources are far away. So there are a number of things, like for vision, such as, you know, things that are further away because of the attenuation of the high frequencies, which is the air. If a signal has less higher frequency, it tends to perceive it as coming from further away. So if you do a mix, if you do music and you mix a song, if you want an instrument to sound like it's further away, don't turn the loudness down. Filter the high frequencies. It will go away more efficiently. You'll still hear it, but further away. If you turn the loudness down, it will more likely disappear. So that's the thing with cocktail party effect, is that the brain image of the signal is probably richer than what we think, just gets to the ear. And the last thing before turning to you, we perceive also with our bones. Scary. But I mean, if you've been in a party where you have loud sounds, I mean, you the bass are perceived by our body. And in fact, if you want to model the way sounds are perceived, if you just put microphones in your ears and then you play this back, it sounds wrong. Because a number of low-pitched sound in particular, or lower frequencies, are perceived through the fact that they make our bones resonate, and that our bones are connected to our hearing system, and so that contributes to our auditory perception. So it's not just the airwaves, or not just the airwaves on the eardrums, it's also the airwaves through our body.
I just wanted to add about the 3D sound here,
yes,
because the brain calculates the differences between the two channels when
yeah,
it gets filtered by the head, the sound that comes to each ear.
So, yes and yes. So that's the interaural difference, which is the equivalent of the stereoscopic vision. If the source is here, it's going to take more time to get to my left ear than to my right ear, because my right ear is closer. However, again, if it's far away, the difference is too small to be actually perceivable. The more important effect, as I understand from what I've read, is the filtering, as you said. Because the sound, even though the sound here is exactly the same, when it reaches my left ear, it's going to have been filtered by my head. So it's more the difference in the frequency spectrum between the ears for signals that are far away that are taken into, well, that are used to discriminate and to locate in 3D. The other thing that is interesting is, even if you take into account those differences in what gets to the ears, it doesn't explain how I can tell whether the source is in front of me or behind me, or above my head or below my feet. And in fact, a lot of people have done work on 3D audio, which, you know, is a big deal would be a big deal in the movie industry and things like this. They often find that people make mistakes between front and back, and less often up and down, because up and down we tend, you know, in nature, the sounds that come from underneath the ground tend to be the big rumbling sounds, like an earthquake, and the other sounds tend to come from above the horizon. So we tend to, even if there's a confusion in the signal you perceive, your brain says, well, it has to come from above. Front and back is more common in terms of making mistakes when you use a 3D sound. And then the last piece here is that visual perception is not monomodal, it's multimodal. We receive a signal that is visual, auditory, sometimes olfactory, and sometimes involves touch. And the brain combines all these things together. So going back to the cocktail party effect, you've probably noticed that it's a lot easier to understand what people are saying if you look at them than if you don't. But if you look at them and you turn off the sound, I don't know that anybody here knows how to read on lips, right? So it's something, you know, what is it in the visual signal that helps us understand people? And I think even though we don't know how to read on lips, we do know some of the correlations. So with, you know, some of the audio signal and the visual signal, we get more than if we have either one. And so there is an experiment that has been done to try to understand, again, with this idea of illusions or tricks, how the correlation between visual and audio plays out. And so what you do is you go into a theater, you pull down the curtain, behind the curtain you put a loudspeaker, in front of the curtain you put a person. And this person is going to speak or sing, maybe, in playback. So the visual stimulus will come from the person, but the audio stimulus will come from the loudspeaker that's in the back. And of course, the people in the audience don't know. The question is, how far away do I have to be from the speaker for the audience to detect that there is something wrong? And it's pretty amazing, because you have to be really several meters away for the inconsistency to be detected. And if you ask people where the sound comes from, it's the vision that dominates. If there's conflicting information, vision will take precedence. And I think, again, it's, you know, in terms of evolutionary term, you know, we know that sound has to come from somewhere, so we'll trust, and we know that there are phenomena like echo and other things that we don't trust as much our 3D location of sound as we trust what we see. Now I'm talking about hearing, and that unfortunately, I think sound is not used enough in user interfaces. There was a system that was built years ago by Bill Gaber called the Sonic Finder. And that was in the maybe late 80s, early 90s. And he had added sound to the Finder, which is the system to manipulate, navigate files on the Mac. And the idea is each time you clicked on an icon or you dragged an icon, you had a sound. Now the thing is that if it's just the sound that says, you know, you've clicked, it's not interesting. The thing is the sound told you something about the file that you could not necessarily see. For example, the pitch of the sound would tell you how big the file is or how large the folder is. So if it's a high-pitched sound, it would sound like it's small or not very full. If it's a low-pitched sound, it looks like it's big. The timbre of the sound, whether it would feel like you are hitting glass or wood or plastic, and we are very good at detecting those different sources, would tell you the type of file that it is, which usually you can also tell visually. But and the interesting thing is that Apple was really excited about this and was going to put it as part of the normal distribution of the Finder. And then he was asked to give a demo. And of course, to give a demo of an auditory interface, you want to make sure people hear. So you had to crank up the volume. And people said, well, you know, I don't want all these sounds on my computer when I work. The thing is that his system worked perfectly well if you had it extremely, extremely low. I don't know if you've been in a building when there is a power outage and everything is down. It's a lot more silent than you think. So there's ambient noise all the time. I can hear the projector humming. On your hard drive, on your computer, you can hear the hard drive spinning. And again, because our ear is very, very sensitive to even very faint sound, you could benefit from this auditory feedback without having it loud at all. So there is a field of, in the same way there's information visualization, there's a field of auditory visualization, or auditory display, I think it's called, where it's trying to use sound to reveal information about things. It's particularly effective when you're trying to show temporal processes. Because our ear is very good too at detecting patterns in sound. So drumming patterns. And if you have a drummer and he makes a mistake, you even if you're not trained, you hear it immediately. And so I know there has been some visualization, display made for debugging parallel systems, where each process, you know, makes a sound when some event occurs, and then you hear it, and then you can tell with a bit of training if it does the right thing or not. But it's like, you know, when driving your car, if it starts making a weird noise, you notice. So, I mean, it's all these things. The thing I wanted to show you here is an auditory illusion. Although I'm going to play it rather than show it. And so it's a sounds, well, it's the best to, I guess, play it. It's not very loud, sorry. Spooky, isn't it? So your perception is this sound is going down and down and down. And your brain says, no, that can't be. But still, it's going down and down and down. So it's called the Shepard Rissay sound or tone. And what you have here is the frequency content as time goes on. Essentially, you have a frequency that so the sound is a combination of multiple frequencies, and you have one frequency that starts high pitch, and it does a glissando. The pitch goes down, and as it goes down, it gets louder and then fainter again and disappears. And by the time it's gone down, several others have entered the auditory spectrum. So what you hear, what your ear is doing, is that it's sort of latching onto one of these frequencies and then following it. But at some point, you can't hear it anymore, so you latch to another one, and it goes down. So you have this eerie feeling that it's going down, even though it's always at the same pitch. And I put these two images. You probably know these images from Escher. Right? You do. So this is the infinite staircase. So if you look carefully, the stairs is going up and up and up and up and up and up. And this is the infinite fountain. So fountain goes down here, water flows down here and here and here and here and goes up again. And I mean the parallel is actually pretty strong, because here too your eye is doing a local analysis. And locally everything seems right. And Escher has done many things, like there's a Necker cube and other things. So your eye builds, you know, I was saying a lot of the perception goes sort of top down, but here your eye first it sees a stair, so it's nothing unusual with that, and then you try to analyze, you need to focus, and locally everything is right. And then you try to put the pieces together, and then something is wrong. And then you have this conflict. So it's the same thing that's happening with this auditory illusion. Now, the reason I showed this is because a long time ago with a student, we were working on the use of auditory feedback in user interfaces. And we used Shepard reset tones to give an auditory feedback of downloading a file. So we were using one that was going up rather than down. I don't know, it sounded better. The down one is a little bit depressing. When it's sliding up, it's a bit more. But what we're doing is, one thing you can do is vary the speed at which it seems to be going up and down. So, you know, when you download a big file, there's two situations. Either you know how big the file is and how long it's going to take, and that's a progress bar. And that's very easy. You can have a sound that goes from an initial pitch to a target pitch, and you follow the curve. What we're looking at is when you don't know how long it's going to take. And so what we were doing is using this sound and changing the speed at which it seems to go up according to how quickly it is downloading. And that meant that it could sort of monitor this type of processes without having to look at the progress bar. And with more information than what you have in the progress bar, because usually when you have a progress bar for a process that the system doesn't know how long it's going to take, you have, you know, either the spinning wheel or some you know, this progress bar that, but it doesn't give you feedback of how fast it's going and things like this. Okay, let's move on. Touch. One more touch. That's difficult. That's another one that is complicated. And it's complicated in part because there's no one sense of touch. There's about eight. So, first, under what should be called literally touch, which involves physical contact and the perception of when there is a physical contact between your skin and an object, is itself made of six types of sensors. So you have sensors that detect hot, they're different from those that detect cold, although when you get something too cold, it also activates the hot ones, that's why it looks like, you know, icebergs. Pain, different sensors. There are people who are not sensitive to pain. It looks good, it's terrible, because they hurt themselves all the time, they don't notice. Pressure. And touch in the notion of the texture of the object you touch, which has two levels of sensitivities. So So this alone is already quite complicated. And here, I don't know where I found this image, but I don't know how how realistic it is in representing this different types of sensors in your skin, but you get the idea. Now, in recent years, there's been quite a bit of work on what's called multi-touch interfaces, as you know. And, well, the thing is, they are very poor in the sense that they capture information when you touch a surface, but the feedback you get is completely static. Static in the sense that it depends on what type of glass or plastic they decided to use for this touch surface. And there are some people that, you know, don't like, I mean, the iPad is in fact pretty sticky. But if it's too slippery, it's not good either. But the point is, you get feedback because you know when you're touching or not touching. But the system is not conveying information through touch. Now, in the last few years, there are people who have tried to look at how we could add to the surface of the screen a way to create a touch sensation. Now, we're going to do another very small experiment. If you close your eyes, and just in front of you, if you touch different parts of the desk, or a piece of paper, or your laptop, or your clothes, or whatever, I mean, it's amazing how your fingers are sensitive and can detect, you know, that paper is different from wood, it's plastic, in fact, or from metal of your computer, or from fabric, or things like this. So, if we were able to use that in a touch interface, the advantage is that, well, first, maybe you'd be able to operate it in the dark, but you could also convey more information than what you see. You could make it so that when you reach the border of an object, you feel a little ridge, a little groove. So you could guide interaction through tactile feedback. So there are several people who've done various systems that actually give you tactile sensations. One of them is by actually vibrating the touch surface at very high frequencies. Gives you an impression of something that is more a rough surface or more, what's it called? Smooth. There's another technique that's using electric stimulation. So, you know, sometimes when you touch at my home when I touch the fridge, you get this kind of so it's because you're closing an electrical loop, and so but you feel it as a touch sensation. It looks like the surface is weird. So there are people who've done that as well, and there are people of other technologies. The problem at the moment is, first, they tend to require a lot of power, so it wouldn't work on the mobile device in your pocket unless you had a battery in a backpack. The other problem is that they change the touch surface altogether, so you wouldn't be able to have different touch sensations on different fingers. So in the multi-touch interface, it's sort of not what we're looking for. So these things are happening. One of the systems I have in mind is called Tesla Touch. It's done by one of those was done by former students of ours, but I don't know if it's this one or another one. But if you look for Tesla Touch, then you can look at references around it and find other things. But that's only part of the story of what tends to be put under touch. The other one is proprioception. And proprioception is based on sensors you have in your joints that tells your brain what is the configuration of your body. That is, I'm sure it's something you probably have never thought about. How do you know you're sitting? Or that your arm is raised? Or, I mean, you know, because your body, right? Well, there are signals that come from your joints that tell your brain the configuration. And the other day when we did the thing with touching an object to recognize it, the way you are able to reconstruct the shape of the object in your brain from what you are touching is with proprioception, plus tactile feedback as well. But proprioception, you need to know, to find out if the object is small or big, you need to know if your hand is, more open or more closed. I see you. You seem... you don't believe me?
But is it not also the tension of the muscle as well?
Well, the receptors for proprioception, we'll get to kinesthesia. And the two things are linked. So with proprioception, it's really the position. And the sensors are in the joints. For kinesthesia, which is the effort that your muscles are doing, the receptors are in the muscles. And of course, all of these things play together. The surface contact, the configuration of the limbs, and the effort. So if I put two objects in your hand, and one is heavier than the other, it's kinesthesia that will tell you that you need more effort in your muscle to counteract the weight. But when you explore an object, the shape of an object, it's more proprioception. I don't know, have you been on these rides where they make you turn in all sorts of directions and try to get you confused? It tries to confuse your proprioceptive sense and your kinesthetic sense. Now for kinesthesia, there are a number of systems that have been built in virtual reality environments to try to provide people with kinesthetic feedback. And the reason is when you are in a virtual environment, the objects, you can see them, but you can walk through them. They don't exist other than your visual perception. And so a number of systems have been built, usually where you have something you hold in your hand, an arm, that gives you this kinesthetic feedback. The best system I've used that really really impressed me was, in fact, a little ring that is connected with six strings. It's called a spider. So you have a little ring. It's connected with six strings to six with thin cables to six motors, and then the system controls the tension of the motors. And it was a demonstration where I was supposed to, attach a door to a car or something like this. Oh no, to put, to attach a door. And so with this, so you put your finger in this ring and you can move around. And depending on where you are in the scene, you'll get the motor that pull the other way. But you get extremely intense sensation of hitting the corner of an object. Which you don't get with the other kinesthetic feedback devices, which are these big arms and also big motors, but you don't get this. It's very hard to generate a sensation of you're hitting the corner of something. Because the forces, the impact forces, are extremely high. Extremely short, that's why you don't get hurt, but extremely high. And so mechanically, it's very hard to create. Yes?
Can you explain about the way that you handle the device? The objects in the virtual world was with the ring, but it was the ring gave you the information about the force.
So you wear the ring, or in another situation, they had put some objects like a pen in the ring. So the ring is a way to transmit to either your finger or the object some feedback forces. Right. So when if you're moving in the,
if
so you can move the ring.
Right.
So if you're in the, if there is no object, you can move the ring freely. The strings, the motors don't react, so you can move it freely. But if you hit an object, it can, with the six motors, it can give you, it can create a force that is like when you're hitting.
The ring, right?
Yes. You explore the scene with the ring.
Like an amount.
Yes. Yeah,
sort of a 3D mouse, but where you get feedback. And in fact, speaking of mice, there are people trying to do mouse that also give you kind of feedback. So, you know, if you hit the side of the screen, it will give you some feedback in the mouse. And again, this is a space that has been explored in research. And I think we are in this long nose of innovation. One of these things about the touch feedback on surfaces or some of these things in VR system. One day, you know, one of these is going to work out in the marketplace because they'll found a good application, a cheap way to manufacture it, or something like this, and it will become big because it's been in the labs for over 20 years. So we don't know which one is going to come out, but I'm sure it's going to come out. And I mean, it's a, again, if you think in normal life how you use all this sensory information to just operate in the world. There's a lot really to be communicated through other channels than vision. Right now our computers are really overloading the vision channel. There are things you can do through audio, and yes, audio doesn't work everywhere. I mean, if you're in a noisy environment, it's not going to work very well. But certainly touch could be used a lot more. And it doesn't have to be necessarily the full complex, you know, addressing all the senses of touch that we have here. It could be done in a much reduced way, but you have to find the right application, the right way to do it, and we'll see what happens. So we've seen the senses. What senses didn't I talk about?
Hearing, visual.
Yeah, so which one did I not talk about?
Smell.
Taste.
Olfactory and
taste. Smell and taste. Well, there are people who work on this. I don't know. I don't have much to say. I mean, I have seen papers that have tried to create olfactory interfaces and taste. So there is work in this area, but it's really, really marginal at this point and very small applications. So I have to make sure so we can move forward in the class. So we talked about perception, let's talk a little bit about the motor system, how we create actions. So our motor system, again, it's an amazing thing. I mean, if you think of the number of muscles you have in your body and that you're able to combine them to walk without falling or to run a bicycle or to do things like writing, just writing is so one area where the knowledge of motor control that has been acquired by psychologists has had a big impact is target acquisition. Because on GUI interfaces, but also on touch-based interfaces, and also in virtual reality environments, a lot of the things you do is to point at things, to say, I want to do something with that object, I want to select that menu item, I want to move that file, I want to put the cursor here. So this is called target acquisition in the because it's you know, you're trying to reach a particular target with the reaching gesture. So whether the reaching is done through a mouse, or it's your own finger on a touch surface, or it's through, in 3D environments, they use sticks a lot, so laser, as if it were laser pointing, so you point at things at the distance by having a virtual laser. And it turns out that we have, and it's one of the very rare occurrences in psychology, a very strong empirical law with a formula. And it's called Fitts' law because it was invented, discovered, created, whatever, by Paul Fitts. And so it is Paul Fitts, F-I-T-T-S. So that's what the apostrophe is after. When you write Fitts' law, don't make the mistake of writing F-I-T-T apostrophe S, because his name is Fitts, not Fit. So Fitts' law. And he did a very simple experiment It is a very simple experiment, and it's one of the things, again, I want to illustrate the way research in psychology is done. When you see this experiment, you say, well, you see this is the way to do it. But it is very hard, also in psychology, to do simple things. And in this experiment, it was asking subjects to tap. So he had, that was before computers, or not technically before computers, it was in the 1950s, so, you know. So it has a conductive table here, and it's covering part of it with this piece of cardboard. So these two areas here are conductive, and he has a pen hooked up electrically so that when you touch, it closes a circuit and you can detect when you've touched the target. And the task was tap, reciprocal pointing, tap here and there as fast as you can without missing the target too often. You have to miss it every once in a while to show that you're at the limit of your performance. You don't want to be too safe. And that's the task. And what you do, you vary two variables. The amplitude, how large you have to go, can be, you know, arm's length or just tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk. And the width of the target. What is the precision that is required? Large target, easier. Small target, harder. Large amplitude, takes more time to traverse. Small amplitude will get right there. And so then you try to see there is a regularity in the data. And what he found is that the movement time, the time it takes to go from an initial position to given target, was a linear function of this thing, the logarithm of, well, his original formulation didn't have the one, but no one goes into detail, but something that is a function of d over w. Now, the fact there is a d over w there is not too surprising because, as I said, the farther away, the longer it takes. The smaller the target, the longer it takes. So it has to grow with d and decrease with w. And the fact that this is the logarithmic law is very interesting because this was done at the time where information theory was being created by Claude Shannon. And has anybody here done information theory? Yes?
No, but we use it in telecommunication also to know about
And so, don't you remember something with the log of 1 plus signal over noise? You hope you would never have to deal with this again, right? The reason it came up with this is because it had a theory. You don't do this kind of experiments just to see if by some kind of miracle, there is kind of law. You have an idea, and you're testing a hypothesis. And this hypothesis is what you do when you're pointing, is you are communicating information to the system. Because, of course, here the task is operationalized as you have to point here, there's one target, and that's it. In the real world, it's not the case. There are targets all over the place. And you choose that you're picking that target instead of this one. So what you do in a computer system, when you click on an icon, when you click on the menu item, when you click on the cursor, between two characters to position the cursor, is you're telling the system, well, there's all these targets on your screen, here's the one you want. And so this can be interpreted in terms of communicating information to the system. And you can measure this information in bits. So in Fitts' law here, this thing, logarithms of 1 plus d over w, is called the index of difficulty. And it's measured in bits, because d over w has no dimension. And when you apply a log in reference to information theory, it measures the negative entropy, and you can measure it in bits. And with our limbs, we are able to produce movements, target acquisitions, movements,
for an index of difficulty up to about 12 bits. 12 bits, that means that the ratio between the distance to the target and the size of the target can be up to 2 to the power of 12, which is 4,000. So, just a quick experiment in the head, a little bit of math. If I do an amplitude of 1 meter, you know, my arms can go, you know, close to 2 meters if I really stretch. So let's take 1 meter, which is kind of a comfortable range. If I have a target of 1 millimeter, you see what a millimeter is? Yes? So a meter is 1,000 millimeters. So the ratio of D over W is 1,000. And so the index of difficulty is going to be about?
100.
No, log of 1,000. Log base 2.
2.
Oh, come on. You don't know your table of powers of 2?
10.
10, yes.
Okay.
So it's about 10 bits. So pointing a target at 1 millimeter, 1 meter apart, that's 10 bits of information. And the law here says that time is going to be some constant plus another constant times this. The constants, they depend on the user. They depend on the apparatus. They depend on the number of factors, but if we were to do this with a mouse, A tends to be very small, so let's ignore it, and B tends to be around 0.1. So 0.1 times 10 bits, it takes about a second to acquire a target of a millimeter.
So A and B are like related to the modality? I mean, what we use?
Yes, yes. And in fact, a lot of the things we do in HCI is we take this for granted and we compare the performance of different devices or different techniques by comparing the A and B. So if the B is higher, it's less good. And so there are experiments, early experiments that were done comparing a joystick, pointing with a joystick versus pointing with a mouse. Experiments comparing if you have the mass with or without acceleration, etc., etc. And it's a very powerful way of comparing performance.
And why A is not always equal to zero? Because the
that's a very good question. It should. The thing is, you know, talking about information theoretic stuff is nice. It doesn't explain how our body does that, because I don't think our body is waiting for Claude Shannon to tell it how to operate. So there are several theories on how the muscle, the motor system works. One of them is that you have an initial ballistic phase, so you throw your arm, and then you try to control it. And so if you look at the velocity profiles of how your arm actually moves, you tend to see, yes, this initial fast phase and then adjustments, which are sort of little bounces. So you get close and then you slow down, and then you slow down too much, so you accelerate again, and etc. until you reach the target. Sometimes you overshoot, you go beyond the target, you go back. So there is this model by Mayer and others, which is this kind of multiple incremental movements. It's not the only one. With this theory, they actually explain, in a sense, this law. But what was your question exactly?
Why A is not equal to zero?
Oh, wait, yes, why A is not equal to zero. If it's actually a good way to control for your experiment. If you get an A that is too large, if you get an A that is negative, there is something fishy. There is something strange. It can be in your experimental design. What is very powerful about this protocol is when we analyze it, we drop the first two pointing, and then we look at the phase where you are really going back and forth. But for some pointing techniques, we cannot do that. And detecting when the motion starts is not always easy. So you have noise in there that gets put into A. But if you have an A that is, above, 0.2 seconds, if you have an A that is way negative, maybe it is also that your technique or your experimental setup means that you're not in following Fitts' law.
But if you do an experiment with any kind of interface,
yes,
and you take the distance, you put the distance to zero, so you don't move,
yes.
I can't imagine that you will take some time to move.
Now, there's a big debate in the community about this, because I think if you are looking at low IDs, now of course if your distance is smaller than the width of the target, if you're already in the target, there's no pointing going on. So it's not interesting. What I claim is that if you're looking at very low IDs, it's not interesting either. And if you have weird things going on there, because okay. There's this whole thing of the real ID versus the effective ID. We don't have a... Now the theory is you start from here, you have your target here. And so you measure D to the middle of the target. That's D. Now, if you have a very low ID, you're going to have something like this. This is your target, and you start from here. Now, do you really think you're going to shoot for the middle of the target? No. You're going to shoot here. So, even though the experimental distance was this distance, the observed distance tends to be much smaller. And some people call this effective distance.
Okay, so it's
and so you need to correct. And so you have two schools of thoughts. One that say that, you know, abide to effective width and effective distance and correct all the data, the formulas according, or interpret the formulas according to this corrected measures. And those that say the data is the data. If you didn't operationalize your task well enough, well, deal with it, but don't screw up with the data.
So we can say that
it's a methodological issue.
It's just a model for when D is bigger than the width.
Yes. In fact, Fitts' law has natural limits. On the low end, we just talked about it. If it's too easy, it's not interesting, and you optimize the task. So what's happening at low IDs is always noisy. But there's also a limit that is in your muscle. If I give you a target of 1 micron, you won't be able to reach it. So at some point to the right of the curve, things are going to go completely off. Your error rate, in fact, is going to go very high. Now, one thing we discovered working with, this is part of the work I did with IBIA, and one thing we discovered is we had a tablet that had very, very high sensitivity, much higher than the display of the screen, because on the screen you measure in pixels, so that's your limit size. On this tablet, we had things that were, I don't remember, but like a 50th of a pixel. So really very, very small. And we were able to have movements with 12 bits of difficulty on a tablet that was, I don't know, 40 centimeters. Now, the thing is that if you ask people to do the task, we could not display the target on the screen because it was smaller than the pixel. So what we did is we used magnification. The top of the screen, you would see the overall distance that you were covering. And then near the target, there was a part that was enlarged underneath. So when you entered that area near the target, your cursor would show up in the bottom part and would move much faster because it was magnified. And what we found is that by showing this, by improving your visual system, in a sense, giving you magnifying glasses, you could have really extremely high precision in your mode of control, right? And we went up to 12 bits. And in fact, what was interesting is the higher we went there, the better, the smaller A was. The regression was getting better and better, and the A was getting very close to zero. And I think the interesting part is in the high IDs. So the whole thing I read all the time about low IDs and effective widths and all that, I think, I don't find it interesting myself. Now, the last thing on control I want to talk about here, because I will get back probably to this law one way or the other, is about bimanual control, because that's another thing that's been ignored, and it keeps being ignored by and large. We have two hands. Most of us have two hands. And not only that, but we use them all the time. So, you're taking notes on your paper here. If you had only one hand, has anybody had their arm broken?
No.
Or in a cast, or, no? Yes?
Yeah. Yeah. The problem with you, sir.
Oh, really?
So I had to write with
and it was left hand.
And it was the right hand, and I had to write my exams with the left hand.
Yes.
And it was really challenging.
Yes. I mean, and you can, you know, do the experiment at home. You know, you get up one morning and decide to not use one of your hands until you get out of the house. It's very hard. So a lot of things we do them with two hands without even thinking. In fact, you are taking notes. And you probably don't notice, but as you take notes, you move your page with the left hand. And in fact, the experiment has been done where people were asked to take notes, or in fact, it was a dictation, and to write. And they were writing a piece of paper, but on the table they had put a carbon sheet. So you could see on what part of the table they had written, as opposed to what part of the paper. So of course, if you write a page, you can cover the page. But because they were moving the page along the course of writing, relative to the table, they had written something that was 10 lines of text high. Because they were using their non-dominant hand, left hand for right handers, to be more efficient with the right hand. So this is the theory of bimanual interaction, bimanual control by Yves Guillard, that says that even though our two hands look remarkably different, remarkably similar, they actually do very different things. And what he discovered by studying really everyday actions is that in many, many, many cases, almost all the cases, the non-dominant hand, so your left hand if you're right-handed, will be used first, and it sets the context within which the dominant hand, right hand for right-handers, is going to operate. So your left hand tends to move the sheet of paper around. It tends to hold the pen while you stir with the right hand. And so it sets. So the non-dominant hand is used first, doesn't need much precision, that's why our left-handed is not very precise. And the right hand or dominant hand acts within that context. And so, even though we have symmetric limbs, we have asymmetric use. And in fact, Guillard in his talks used the comparison with it's a type of crab that had developed two very different limbs, one with a very thick, big claw to hold the things it wants to eat, and the other one small and agile to just get the meat. Now, humans, you know, have not evolved in asymmetric limbs, but in nature you have examples. And so there are examples, I'll show one later in the course, it's called tool glasses, and I think you have it in your list of papers, that actually uses this distinction. And the idea is that so you have an interface with either two mice, or preferably one mouse and one trackpad, or one mouse and one trackball. And again, because the trackball doesn't need to be precise. And so, you know this thing called French curves? You use that in school at some point? This is the plastic shapes, and you move them, and the organ is just a ruler. You move the ruler with the left hand, position it, you use it with the right hand. So tool glasses are exactly the transferring this interface to the computer system, where you have tools that you can move over the drawing surface with your left hand, and then with your right hand you do what they call the click through, to say I want to apply this tool at this position. And they found that you could be up to 40% faster with this bimanual interaction. And interestingly, this 40% gain is not due to concurrent action with the two hands. Because in fact, in these bimodal tasks, there's very little overlapping of what you do with the left hand and with the right hand. It's still very sequential. There is a bit of overlapping. But the fact that you assign different roles to different hands makes you save time, even though it's done in a very fairly sequential way. Okay, I feel like we should take a break. Yes? Okay. Go get some coffee, and then at noon we'll have a presentation for the multimodal elective.
Just one question, talking about the track and brush platform. What is the name of the project that the people who are researching on?